You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is as a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker. And a shot.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He's shattered from all. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor at 538. Far to my right, Kate Fagan. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
Kate's an ESPNW columnist, of course. And between us, shining like the stat man he is, Neil Payne, sports writer at 538.
That's a lot to live up to, but How's it going, Chad?
Neil, I think you christened yourself Statman a few weeks ago.
Statman?
Yeah, I at least busted out the cape, so I have no one to blame but myself.
So on the show today, we're going to talk about the case of Duti Chand, an Indian runner who challenged limits on testosterone levels for female runners. And to the surprise of seemingly nearly everyone, she won, lifting the ban. We'll talk about that. Then we'll move on to the 2024 Boston Olympics, which Boston citizens in 2015 have stopped from happening. And then we'll talk about Jurgen Klinsmann, the man that U.S. soccer fans like to think that they could do better than. But first, Brady. So before we enter this studio, while Kate was under the hot lights of Around the Horn, Tom Brady's suspension was upheld by an arbitrator for the NFL, and he's going to miss the first four games. Do we have any insta-react? Not a hot take, right? We want to counter the hot take, but any instant reaction about the numbers about what this might mean?
Well, seeing as how he originally was slated to miss four games, it seems like we could just trot out what we had done before because nothing really changed. And before we had said that it seemed like it hurt the Patriots by like a win and a half or two wins, I believe. And I just called up some numbers.
Over the season, that is.
Yeah, over the season by missing the four games. And just looking at like their playoff odds, NumberFire had run the stats on this earlier, and it was a 5% decrease to the Patriots' playoff chances without Brady playing those four games.
So they would have been 11-5. Now they might be 10-6 or 9-7 and might miss the playoffs 5% more likely because of it. And Neil, didn't you or was it Ben Morris who wrote that the draft pick that the Patriots lost was actually the bigger deal than Brady here? That no matter what the suspension would have been, that long term the draft picks that the Patriots lost because of this was like the real punishment that they got?
Yeah, since he's only going to cost them like 1.5 or 2 wins, then the long-term value of the players that they could have drafted with the assortment of picks that they have to relinquish now and still have to relinquish under the terms of the current and ongoing suspension, we're going to be more valuable to the Patriots anyway than losing Brady for these four games. So nothing has changed, and the Patriots are still kind of starting the season at a disadvantage and potentially at an even bigger disadvantage long term.
It's going to be an odd look for the NFL in week 5, right, when the Cowboys play the Patriots and Greg Hardy is back after his four game suspension and Brady's still out because they have a bye week, and so that will be his fourth game if it's upheld. I mean, the conversation that week is going to make the NFL make it clear how arbitrary a lot of these things
are. No, their offenses were equivalent, so there's not going to be any kind of debate at all about that.
The optics.
Yeah.
We're talking about more Brady during Significant Digits when Allison McCann will be here, so I'm going to let's put a pin in that, guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right? We're used to historic moments happening in sports all the time, right? We relive them. We watch replays and replays. But we're mostly used to seeing them on the field, it seems to me, or the court or the ice or whatnot. Something, to me at least, happened earlier this week that could just as easily define the next few decades of international sports and international athletics when Duti Chand, an Indian sprinter who has spent the last year appealing a decision that banned her from competing in track and field internationally, because of her elevated but natural testosterone levels. And so this week, the Court of Arbitration of Sport said that actually that ban was not okay, that that there wasn't a scientific basis that elevated testosterone levels so improved her performance that she wasn't going to be – it wasn't fair for her to compete against other women. And so now she's going to be able to compete. And importantly to me, and Kate, you've written about this, so correct me if I'm wrong – if track's governing body can furnish enough evidence that there is an advantage to having elevated natural testosterone levels in the next 2 years, mm-hmm. then these regulations will be back in place. Does that read of it correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, if the IAAF can somehow put together the science or find scientists or find the science to show a significant correlation between naturally occurring testosterone and an advantage, and we're talking a greater advantage than any sort of genetic advantage, like height and Michael Phelps, long limb, something like that, because nobody's disputing that testosterone or even having naturally high testosterone doesn't provide some sort of advantage. It just doesn't rise to the level of flagging and banning. And I think what's interesting is, like, this story is flying a little under the radar, I think, for the mainstream for lots of different reasons. But and it might be because nobody's really looking down the road at why this ruling will matter. But it matters because the IAAF and the IOC,
which is, IAAF is the track authority. Yeah.
And the Olympics, so the IOC, they worked in tandem to create the female hyperandrogenism policy. So if the Olympics, when they gather around a table in November to approve all of their regulations for Rio in 2016, they really can't uphold this sex testing regulation that they created in tandem.
Then they would be liable to be.
Because they've already seen how the highest court in the sports land has ruled on this. So they can't really in good faith and say, well, we're sticking with that policy. Now, then you go down the line. There are a lot of other international governing bodies that have looked toward the Olympics and the IAAF to set their standards. And in some ways, it's like FIFA and rugby and, you know, rowing and maybe swimming. I haven't taken a close look at their policy. So you're talking about a sweeping verdict here that would wipe out any sort of sex testing, which is essentially what the what people who study it say the female hyperandrogenism policy is. Like, although it's although they're doing well semantically, it really is just a sex testing policy in the old form of sex testing policy when they did like a naked parade.
But dressed up within science, you mean?
Exactly.
So we spent a long time looking for takes for this segment, mm-hmm. and surprise! I was expecting really virulent ones, right? About gender and sex and what's fair and whether a woman was a man, whatever else. Weirdly, the conversation seemed to be restrained, and this might be, Kate, the idea that sort of under the radar or sort of so different from mainstream conversations that we don't quite know
honestly,
how to
I
take
think
about
one,
it.
One, it's like the phrase female hyperandrogenism. Like, most people who are going to offer hot takes are going to be stopped right there because they're like kind of baffled by what that means. And right. In essence, that's part of the policy. Plus, when I wrote a column about FIFA's sex testing, there was plenty of hot takes on Twitter about, you know, well, you can't let men play. You know, this is what it's about. It's about men dressing up as women to play, which was hot, you know, a very hot take since there's really very few episodes of that happening. So it's part of there's no direct news peg right now because we're not in the middle of the Olympics. And plus that simple phrasing just scares a lot of people mm-hmm. away because they're like, I don't even know how to decode that. I don't really know what it means. So I don't know how many hot takes I can offer about it.
So I want to get to, instead of a hot take, to read a quote that Chand herself said. And I thought it was really interesting for us to discuss it because to me this is a story not about analytics but about measurement, which to me feels pretty native to what we talk about a lot, which is how you evaluate somebody. In this case, the evaluation is in a fraught space about gender, which you know we can certainly discuss, and also perhaps invasion of privacy issues and others. So Chand herself said, quote, I'm very thankful to the judges of the appeal committee that they have taken a close look at my case and given the decision in my favor. I have got justice. I am a normal girl. And that last bit's really interesting to me because mm-hmm. this idea of normalcy and whether normalcy can be measured is a really fraught thing. And we're seeing this across society now when we you know, there's a large conversation going on around transgender issues in broader society. And this idea of normalcy, we used to define, to me, normalcy based on a little bit based on science. And now spectrum, I feel like, is just a word that's used about all sorts of what we of things that we once thought were binaries.
Yeah. Well, the difficult part about that is like the court, the sport court has basically ruled that there's just no scientific measurement that they think is valid to determine sex. But what you just saw Duty say was that certainly there is societally wise, right? I mean, she truly experience what it's like when you're not adhering to one of the extremes of gender as we play out in society. If you're not identifying and performing gender in the way we want, and then if scientifically you're challenged as to your sex, two different things, gender and sex, the kind of shame and embarrassment that our society causes when someone seems outside of the normal bounds of gender, normal bounds of gender and sex.
But what's interesting to me is that this, like in men's sports, we often acclaim being abnormal in like such a positive direction.
He's a freak.
Right, exactly. How often do we throw that term around and it seems to kind of connote extra, you know, superhuman athletic ability? And there's, and, you know, in women's sports, it really is like kind of a fraught issue where you don't want to be too, you know, you don't want to be abnormal, but the nature of excellence in sports is to be abnormal in a lot of ways. And one of my questions about this that I had for you, Kate, was like when they're testing these, we talk about normal, like naturally occurring testosterone levels, which I think is kind of an interesting distinction to make. When we look at like the other policies toward like steroids mm-hmm. and things like that, is that those are abnormally occurring. They're not naturally occurring. But is there a way to separate that where they can say, okay, well, you, we've tested you at this level of testosterone, but it naturally occurred in your body, but we've tested someone else where it's the result of some kind of performance enhancing drug. And so we can make that distinction. Or is the problem here that they can't actually make that distinction?
Well, and that's part of the issue, is that because of international sport and what we've seen over the last 10 years in cycling and running, is that you're making a lot of journalists and everyday people who are watching are making the connection that, well, maybe she's doping, you mm-hmm. know, like the, and then passing it off as naturally occurring testosterone. And maybe that's what's really happening here behind closed doors that we don't know about. That's not really the case. I mean, in all of the bioethicists that I've spoken with, there are certain measurements where you know that it's naturally occurring testosterone and it's not synthetic doping. And, mm-hmm. and it's important to know, because a lot of people will justify having this policy by saying, well, men are tested for doping and testosterone as well. But the difference there is that, yes, men are tested for testosterone, but as soon as scientifically it's proven that it's naturally occurring, they're free to go. And it doesn't matter how high their testosterone is. They could have triple the average man. And again, I don't even know what these numbers mean because they're so arbitrary, of course, but, and it's totally fine.
That would be seen actually as kind of like what you said. It would make them a freak in a positive way.
Yeah, you'd be like, he's a man's man. He's the strongest. He's all these things. And he could have triple the advantage over the average male athlete in testosterone levels. Now, when a woman, once it's found out to be not synthetic doping and it's naturally occurring, then as soon as she hits whatever boundary the different organization has set, then she's banned.
Which is totally arbitrary.
Totally. I mean, they're trying to pinpoint a level that, you know, certainly athletes, even female athletes, are mm-hmm. going to have higher levels. A lot of times will have higher levels of testosterone than, like, the population because they're, you know, stronger and lifting. And there's a certain mm-hmm. measurements. But whatever line they've set, like, you couldn't really name as, like, should be pinpointed the line. It's totally arbitrary.
So the double standard to me is working in all sorts of different ways here. And one of the interesting ones is that and this gets to the freak idea, which is the freak in the male sense, which is that we are trying in men's sports, we expect the men to pursue excellence and iterate and get better and better. But if you're trying to limit women based on testosterone, then you're asking women's sports not to try and get better and achieve more and more and more. And in David Epstein's book, The Sports Gene, which is like this hallmark mm-hmm. book for sports science, he wrote about a 2012 study that spent 3 months following female athletes from a range of sports, including track and field. And he showed that the study showed that elite level competitors had testosterone levels that consistently remained more than twice as high as those of non-elites. And so great women athletes are going to have higher testosterone levels. And so if we want great female athletes, then this is going to be part of the conversation.
It's a total double bind, because I wrote about this with Brittany Griner when she left Baylor before the WNBA. It's like, doesn't she technically embody everything we say we're missing in women's sports? I mean, when Shaq came onto the scene, he was labeled like a freak in an awesome way, and he could, you know, he could dunk and he was powerful down low. And then you saw Brittany Griner coming along, and she was dunking and she was challenging the boundaries and bringing the game along in the way that everybody says it's supposedly lacking compared to the men's game. But once she started pushing those boundaries, it was like, oh, like, she's too much, quote unquote, like a man, and it's like, quote unquote, you know, not fun to watch, and it's not, you know, beautiful. And so then you've got women's sports in a bind where they can never evolve to the athleticism you want because they're trying to pursue traditional notions of femininity as well.
We saw that with Serena Williams the other week. I don't think we ever talked about that. Mm-hmm. There was a New York Times article that wrote about Serena Williams maybe not being as dominant, was it, because she had a male physique or something like that?
No, that other players on the tour didn't want to pursue the kind of strength training and the physique that Serena possessed, because they, you know, when you broke it down, it was that they cared more about embodying traditional notions of femininity than they did about winning. Honestly, like, that was the core point.
So the critique
of the
was about the other players more than about Serena's physique.
The article itself probably was lacking as enough critique in general, but that seemed to be the takeaway about such a high profile sport like women's tennis, where you'd think the money and everything, they would want their bodies to be however they needed to be to win.
Right, and that's such an ugly kind of stereotypical notion that comes up every time Serena Williams wins at all, especially in, like, dominant fashion, is, oh, she, you know, the trolls on Twitter come out and say she looks like a man, it's too much, you know, too masculine. And it really is such an interesting and tough thing to look at, because we went back and we looked at track and field times and, you know, swimming times between men and women, and there really is that gap between the two that hasn't really been closed. And somebody had written at The Atlantic about this golden ratio, where the best men's times are usually about 90% of the best women's times, like the world record. So we have this sense that women are, you know, naturally going to be lagging behind athletically than men. But like you guys had said, it really feels like we're enforcing that at this point, where it's going
Enforcing even more than that, right? That
right.
If you take away the top tier in track, let's say, and there was a stat I saw on WBUR's It's Only a Game, that 7 out of 1,000 elite female track athletes have hyperandrogenism.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, you know, a number out there. When you're at the Olympics, you're pulling from the top of the top. So if you are enforced, if you're cutting off those top elites, then that 90% would be the 90% of the men's times would be 85% or 80%, because you're taking away the people who can most get close to them,
right? Yeah,
perhaps.
And we're almost using that gap as an excuse to justify, instead of marveling at performances which occur naturally that might close that gap. Instead, we're saying, no, this is the ceiling. You have to stay, you know, under that, and that's the way it's always going to be.
You have no control of staying under it.
And then you've got, you know, as you mentioned, that top layer, and possibly women who have been flagged for some of this testing and then put through this obstacle course publicly a lot of times. That's sending a pretty significant signal, not just to other female athletes, but to younger female athletes, about what it means to actually maintain that balance between being a woman and being a competitive athlete, which limits the ascension of female athletes and the progression. And also, it's like we separate men and women from, like, boys and girls from, like, age 5 on the soccer field. So then we're shocked as they grow up and you see, like, more of a division between performance. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say there's no difference physically between men and women, but it's certainly exacerbated by the way we send them on different paths, like, before they can barely even kick a soccer ball. If you take that sport, for example, like, if they were playing together until they were 18, the division over time would probably be it would shrink.
And one of the more jarring things about all the coverage that I've read is, so there are operations that you can do to lower the level of your testosterone, but then some women are getting cosmetic surgery to appear more like women on their genitals or otherwise, which has nothing to do with their levels of testosterone. And so that's only reinforcing, I suppose, this gender split that otherwise wouldn't need to happen because of this larger pressure that's going on.
It's like gender policing more than anything about your presentation and what it means to be a woman. And if you are violating those, then you're flagged for this testing a lot of times.
So, Kate, before we move on, so what's the next step? Is Chand now, she's going to compete and free to compete, and we'll hear about it in 2 years or it'll just disappear this will be the new normal?
You know, I don't know. I haven't compared, like, her times and where she would be in terms of competing and being a presence at the Olympics, but she's certainly an Olympic hopeful for India, which I don't know how that measures when we talk about, like, actually her being a front runner or a competitor once she got to Brazil. But she's now from yesterday eligible to compete and get back on track to qualifying for Brazil, and so it certainly should be a story over the next year leading into Rio. You know, even if she's not competing for the gold medal, she'll be in some of those heats if she does make that team, and then we can continue the conversation about what this means and what it means for women's sports and sports in general going forward.
Okay, for those of you watching the video on 538.com, thanks for watching. And for those listening to the podcast, here's a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. You know the drill by now. SeatGeek aggregates tickets for all sorts of sports and music events and grades them all by their deal score, a fancy algorithm that tells you whether a ticket is cheap compared to past precedents for the event, where the market's headed, etc. You've heard me say this for months. You've been going to random sporting events because of this for months, so I'm going to spare you a new random sporting event. For those of you who haven't been to a random sporting event because of this ad, there is still time. When you make your first purchase on SeatGeek, be sure to use our promo code TAKEDOWN to get a $20 rebate. SeatGeek is your ticket to sport this summer. This week, Boston decided that with all those World Series rings, it didn't need any Olympic-sized ones. After months of debate and grousing, Boston removed its bid to host the 2024 Olympics. The mayor, Marty Walsh, said that he couldn't let the city cover cost overruns.
I refuse to mortgage the future of the city away. I refuse to put Boston on the hook for overruns. And I refuse to commit to signing a guarantee that uses taxpayers' dollars to pay for the Olympics.
So maybe it's where I'm sitting, which is as an editor of 538, where, like, technocrats rule the world. But it seems to me like everyone has woken up to the idea that the Olympics and the World Cup are an awful deal for countries all at once. That in the last 10 years, we have seen the conversation around, since New York tried to get, I think, the 2012 Olympics, and they wanted to build that stadium on the West Side Highway or whatever that was, mm-hmm. that the Jets were going to play in afterwards, yeah. too, right? Yeah. That, like, everyone realizes that giving prime real estate, for developed countries, giving prime real estate is a bad idea because you're only going to use it however many times a year, and you could get much more value otherwise. And for developing countries, that giving that much infrastructural investment to one thing that maybe isn't optimized for later use is also a bad deal. Am I making this up? This is a broader cultural thing. I have a tendency of doing that.
Making up the tendency toward people being more skeptical of the Olympics?
And we'll get to the polling around it in a second. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of simple economics. And there have been like a lot of sports economists that have beaten this drum for many years that, you know, despite all the promises that are made by the PR firms that are hired by, you know, people on the committee to bring the Olympics to, you know, your city, that it doesn't really generate anything positive economically, or at least not to offset the investment costs when you host one of these mega events. And that goes for the World Cup, too.
There's got to be a sweet spot, though. You know, it's like Boston, certainly, or New York, when you're having to add a stadium specifically for an event, but that had post use. But I understand that there are certain spots where it doesn't work. And then you look at like South Africa going down to, I covered the 2010 World Cup, and then you look at how brutal of a deal that was for South Africa. But there's got to be a sweet spot here for like what country and at what place and what city that has certain infrastructure but not others. Like, where is that sweet spot?
So this economist, Andrew Zimbalist, wrote a book called Circus Maximus that I was reading on the way in today to work. And his contention, which I think is a pretty compelling one, is that where the sweet spot used to be is a totally different place now, which is to say that because security costs are so much higher and because the television profit structure is different than it used to be with the way that television profits are shared with the IOC versus the host country versus the broadcast networks and whatever else, that it's such a narrow ability to actually turn a profit that it's almost no one can. And even when you factor in the long-term effects around tourism, he writes, that there's just no way to turn it. And it's almost through a sort of stubborn emotional attachment mm-hmm. to these big games that we you know, everyone wants to watch them. There's sort of a new not in my backyard situation going on with the Olympics. And it's hard to try and stomach actually having them in your own town.
So the data shows that maybe there is no sweet spot for hosting.
That's based on my reading of
Zimbalist's
economic work, yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense because if you think about it, like a lot of the people that want the Olympics to be brought to a town would be private economic interests, like construction companies and the hoteliers and people that are, you know, going to benefit from the building of these things using, you know, they're ostensibly public facilities, but in fact they're actually kind of private interests are going to be able to make the money off of it. And people have really wised up to that, even in the course of building, you know, major league stadiums and things like that. It's kind of the similar idea where in the past you could get public funds to finance your stadium and then make money off of it yourself as an owner. But I think people are a lot more savvy about that now.
One report I saw said that in South Africa for the World Cup, the construction companies made 10 times the profit during the years of the construction for World Cup stadiums than they did previous to that. And so there's a real private interest that's happening around this. And so one of the questions I have always had, and I think I sort of know the answer, but I want to talk through with you guys, is whether – so it's really hard to get infrastructure spending happening in this country and also other countries. And this is one way that it happens, right? New light rails get built from the airport to downtown in Cape Town or Joburg or whatever. Or you'll have some type of improvement to commerce or the infrastructure around people being able to spend money and helping economy and whatnot. And so if you aren't able to green light that kind of infrastructure spending otherwise, because there isn't this alignment of politics and corporate interests, then is it worth doing it in this way despite the cost overrun? Do you know what, does that
right.
make sense?
No, it makes sense, because I mean, you go to Seattle now and it's not the same thing as an Olympics, but right, it was a World's Fair that brought them their iconic, you know, Space Needle. Or you go to Indy and now they have a slew of hotels and some higher end hotels that they didn't have before because they have hosted Super Bowls. And so, you know, I can totally buy into the fact that, like, overall, you could say that that was not a win-win. But there are certain things that are coming out of these events. And now I'm equating, like, Olympics with Super Bowls, with World's Fairs back in the day, with the World Cup, that are not going to happen. And certain cities have certainly benefited in areas from them. So how do we go about highlighting what the clear benefits are and maximize those and change whatever the algorithm is that produces the end result right now that seems so disastrous for these countries?
Yeah, that's a great question. And maybe the lacking of these economic studies is that, you know, they strictly look at it in the dollars and cents of what's happening right now or just in the short term, and there's may not be a way to account for the benefits of something decades down the road, or the if it sets off some kind of, you know, domino effect where it improves an area that wouldn't have been improved otherwise, and then it helps, you know, expand out from there. But the fact that we're having to turn to some of these more, you know, long range and maybe even convoluted
wishful thinking, yeah.
Yeah, justification sort of plays into the overall point of, you know, you have to be looking for silver linings in these things because they're not easy to find. And another reason why is just if you think about the competition to host one of these events involves outspending the other cities that would bid for them, and you have to kind of outdo them with infrastructure. You have to outdo them on the bid. And there's something in economics called the winner's curse, which shows that if you're you and a bunch of other people are bidding on an item of unknown value, the person that wins the bid is by definition going to be the person that overpaid the most for that item. And it usually ends with someone, you know, whoever gets it being like, oh, now I kind of have buyer's remorse over what I just bid for because it wasn't
Except
worth it.
Except they don't have to pay for it. The citizens do.
I mean, it sounds like over the years we've done a masterful PR job in selling, not we, but whatever, society for hosting these parties as if there's some sort of value in it, and specifically financial value. But I mean, if you just bring it down to a micro level, everybody knows hosting a party costs something.
Right.
I mean, maybe if we just start looking at it like that, like, hey, guess what? We know this is going to cost us a little bit, but here in New York, we want the 20, you know, 42 Olympic Games because we want to throw a big, awesome party. And nobody's going to use those terms, but maybe we need to start looking at it like, do you want it? Do you see a cultural value for your city in that moment?
And what's that value appraised at?
Of course, we're going to try and name and put a figure to that value, but maybe we need to stop thinking of it as like a clear outcome where somehow your city has got like a high financial kickback for it.
So what's interesting as well, and this gets back to the not in my backyard sort of nature of this, is that in in America, people say they want the Olympics to be in America. It's something like 90% of Americans think, I'd love for the Olympics to be in America. That sounds great. That sounds fun. Maybe I'll, you know, fly over to San Francisco and see a crew race or something. But when you ask them whether they want it to take place in their local area, the approval falls to 61%.
Unless you have an Airbnb place. And then you're like, I want it.
And we've seen this a little bit in other countries, too. The number of applicants to host the Olympics, especially the Winter Olympics, which is more of an infrastructural challenge, as well as fewer people watch it on TV so that the revenues are different. It's down to 3 in this last round. And actually, Oslo dropped out. And so that makes it between 2. That was to host the 2022 Olympics. So... like, the larger political structures seem to be wising up to this, and that suggests a reigning of economists and technocrats as the guiding philosophy to a lot of politics, I think.
And I don't know if you're looking way down the road, right, like, there's a lot of Olympic sports that, you know, necessitate facilities that just genuinely will never be used again, like a kayak course or something, and now... I feel like all kayakers are going to be angry, but, you know, at me for suggesting that there are certain elements of the Olympics that create infrastructure that you're definitely not going to use again, and they are a one-off. So do the Olympics become a space where you do pare it down to, you know, the 12 core events in a city that are manageable for way more cities and don't cause all this infrastructure to have to be built?
Yeah, maybe that is representing an efficiency of the market where only the cities that are most well-suited infrastructurally to host these events are the ones putting in for it. And it's just naturally going to be, you know, the range of cities that can host it is going to be shrunk.
Okay, so we'll have to wait to see who hosts the Olympics in 2024. That is not Boston. The U.S. Olympic Committee is thinking about maybe asking L.A. if they would take up the
They love throwing big parties.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Maybe.
You know, when Hot Takedown covers the 2024 Olympics, we'll play this tape. We'll hear what we said then.
Heck yeah.
All right, now let's talk about soccer, the U.S. men's national team. And, of course, we cannot talk about soccer without Allison McCann, our soccer spirit animal. Allison, welcome back to the program.
Soccer spirit animal, I like that.
What animal would you be if you were a soccer spirit animal?
Oh,
you are a soccer spirit animal.
Is that a
thing? I know, but like what animal? Or you think spirit animals are their own animal?
I'm a tiger.
Yeah, I could see you. You're wearing black and orange right now, but you're a tiger, yeah.
Coincidence, but I'm a tiger.
I don't know. Neil, you have a bit of a bear-like countenance. Allison, I'm not sure. All right, I guess we should talk about Jurgen Klinsmann.
But what's his spirit animal?
Oh, man.
A gazelle.
Yeah, but a German gazelle.
A German gazelle. Are there German gazelles?
There must be. Why
are
not?
We just,
Paleolithic.
Are we avoiding talking about the U.S. men's national team? Is that what we're
there
doing right now?
There may be a
reason.
Yeah.
This bad.
Speaking of, here's my little intro. But being a soccer fan of the U.S. men's national team is to be in an existential crisis at nearly all times. The latest moment of panic, the U.S.'s flame out at the Gold Cup, where it was beat by Jamaica and Panama to finish fourth in a tournament it likely should have won, according to the pre-tournament odds that I saw. And now people like Goal.com writer Ivis Hlarsep are calling for Klinsmann's head.
While there's plenty of blame to go around, you could point to several players who just didn't play well enough. The blame has to start with Jurgen Klinsmann, who chose the starting lineup and made the substitutions, and on both counts, he was left disappointed. So what's next? The U.S. has to regroup, get ready for a Confederations Cup play-in match in October, and they really need to win that match to salvage this year and also to help Jurgen Klinsmann save some face.
The blame starts with Klinsmann, but where does it end, guys?
How far does this go down?
So, Neil and Allison, what do we know about the Gold Cup performance? Do we have some numbers about whether it was Klinsmann's fault or the player's fault? How are we supposed to make sense of this?
It seems like it was everybody's fault. Let's just get that out there. But, I mean, it was definitely bad. This is, you know, arguably one of the worst losses for the U.S. men's national team ever. People have been making the case for that. This is the first time the U.S. has lost to a Caribbean nation in the U.S. since, like, the 60s. It was the first time the U.S. has been eliminated from the Gold Cup by a CONCACAF team that, other than Mexico. And it's the first time the U.S. has failed to advance to the final since 2003. So, you know, it was disappointing is an understatement, I think. And I think a lot of people are right to wonder what's going on with Jurgen and this system that we've all been waiting to see, you know, how it does. And it's been 4 years now, and I think people are starting to get a little impatient, and we're not seeing the benefits of his style.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting was that statistically they played some form of the system that, you know, we know Klinsmann emphasizes possession, and that he, you know, kind of has an affinity for some of the more, you know, new wave styles of playing the game. And that involves, you know, not playing the long ball. That involves not doing as many crosses and making shorter passes and kind of working your way down the field. And if you look at the numbers from the tournament, they played like that, basically. They were they had the lowest percentage of long balls. They had the shortest average pass distance. They generated a lot of goals off of their assists. You know, they had precise passing and the shortest average shot distance. So on paper, some of these things should have added up to a good performance. And you can question whether he forced the wrong style on the players that they had, whether the players just didn't execute his plan. It's probably a combination of all of those things. But it shows that, you know, oftentimes, especially in soccer, I feel like they talk about the system, and if only you play within the system, then everything will be great. But they kind of did play within the system, and things were not great.
I wasn't quite as panicky as I heard a lot of other people, and I'd be interested to hear Allison and both of Chad and Neil your take. I guess I wasn't as panicky, one, because they have that play-in game to the
Confederations Cup.
And so I would certainly think it was a complete loss if they were not going to be playing in that in a tune-up then for the World Cup. That's a huge deal. But they have that playing game. And also, like, this is Klinsmann's deal and his kind of internal compass that he has with these young players and with starting lineups and with the whole talent he picks. He's often doing things that surprise people and usually leaning toward younger players. I don't think he's lost that touch with the pool of players. I think certainly he put people in incorrect positions at various times in this tournament, but I think that's a slight correction. I mean, considering the way we had seen them playing, which was better than we'd ever seen, so how can they all of a sudden now be calling for Klinsmann's head?
That's what I was confused about. They beat Holland. They beat Germany in Europe. What possibly could happen between those matches and the Gold Cup? I don't understand that.
I think friendlies are different than international competition. Like, as non-statistical as it is to say, you know, mindsets, players that were there. And that's not to say that those wins aren't good, but now we're in the Gold Cup and now it's competition. And these games matter. These matter for FIFA rankings. And that's when we're performing poorly. So, I don't know. It is really surprising. And I would agree with you, Kate. I usually am on Team Jurgen and having a little bit more faith in giving this guy room to, you know, I think what's really incredible is he's not only obviously the head coach, but he's also now the technical director of U.S. Soccer. So a lot of people have been saying, well, maybe he should just be doing one or the other and not trying to do basically two huge things, which is like be a good coach and be winning, but also be like changing the style of American soccer. Like, those are obviously huge tasks. But to your point about, you know, sort of younger players and development and those things, this Gold Cup for me was really surprising in that we were sort of leaning on a 32-year-old Clint Dempsey to be our only finisher. We're playing, you know, Bradley for 90 minutes, you know, these guys that are like going into their 30s and maybe have one more World Cup. And that was surprising to me that I'm not seeing those, you know, 20, 21-year-olds that that did play in the Holland game, the Stanford student who I'm blanking on his name, which is horrible, that scored in those games. And, like, I wanted to see those players and how they're developing, and we didn't. We saw.
And that's on Klinsmann. I mean, the players didn't play well, but maybe it's on Klinsmann about, and this we talk about all the time, about whether it's the coach or the players. And we heard this in the take. It is up to the coach in soccer in particular to set the lineup and decide who the substitutions are. And in this instance, maybe it's Clinton's fault for not putting the right players in.
But I think there's also something to be said about soccer. Just, you know, even after everything that happened in this tournament, and certainly they didn't play well, if you dig down further into the numbers, they didn't play well in terms of possession or in terms of, you know, shot differential. But in the end, they still only lost once, and it was by one goal. And I often wonder, you know, all the time in soccer, we have these referendums on these coaches that seem to come down to like one or two games, and we use those to, and it's almost invariably like a one goal game that happens. And how much of that is just luck in a lot of ways? Like, we wouldn't judge a manager in baseball on, you know, I mean, sometimes we do, but most of the time I think cooler heads prevail, and we look at like hundreds of games to evaluate them on. But in soccer, we have so few matches to kind of make these determinations on that we have to have everything be life or death, and we use a loss by one goal to be a referendum on 7 years worth of work by someone.
But isn't it the case that some sports you can make better evaluations on a smaller sample than you can in other sports? So baseball, there's a lot of variance in each game, the different pitcher, whatever else. But football is 16 games, and it seems like I have a pretty good sense at the end of the season for how good a team is, even though they've only played 16 times. So could it be that soccer, you know, national teams we see for very small stretches of time, but can I not draw something from that?
Yeah, you could probably draw something. I mean, it's probably not as much as you can draw from football. Maybe more than you could draw from like a baseball game. Maybe it's more similar to hockey. But there's been research that shows that the outcome of any given soccer game is about half skill and half luck.
And I think also Klinsmann has often made the right calls. And he's clearly does interesting things with the lineup, and he played a really young defense, and then he leaned on Dempsey and then Bradley, so you're like, wait, are you going young or are you not going young? But really, it as I mentioned earlier, he has many times tweaked things to a way that it really has turned out well for the U.S. So it's hard to now, when he's not behaving any differently, he just tweaked things the wrong way this time. And this is the first sort of really poor outcome, but you have to lean back on like a well-performed World Cup in 2014, I think we all would say, was generally speaking a success. So if you look back on his history, like, it seems like he's most of the time calibrated correctly in his lineups. And I would expect that more often than what I would expect would happen in the Gold Cup.
Seems like a discussion of process versus outcomes, right? Like, when he has good outcomes, then he is doing great. When he has bad ones, he's not doing as well. And we can't really seem to pinpoint as well, like, how is this process doing? And maybe we don't know for many years now.
So usually this is the time when we say we're going to bring in Allison McCann. We're going to go retrieve her from the office. But you're already sitting here, Allison. Welcome as ever to your Significant Digits segment. Allison, what telling number have you brought us from the world of sports this week?
All right, totally switching gears from soccer. This week's significant digit is 80, or roughly 80, I should say, which is the number of text messages that Tom Brady sent and received each day in the four-month period between November and March.
Each day?
Each day. So it was roughly about 10,000 texts in total on the phone that he then tried to have his assistant destroy. And, you know, normally nothing about Deflategate is interesting to me, but here I am with, I'm just like blown away. To put this a little bit in context, you know, teenagers send and receive about 120 texts per day. So he's not quite on teen levels, but for his age group of 35 to 44 year olds, they send and receive about 50 texts a day, so he's way above that.
But think about his contacts list. I mean, he's got to just have everybody on that list.
Do you think he saves them, though? I bet.
True, they're all just random
numbers.
Yeah,
random numbers. Like, oh, thanks, man. Did it for
but
you.
But, like, after a game, he must just have, like, 180 texts where it's like, hey, nice job. And he's like, cool, man.
But
cool.
This was in the
offseason,
right?
Copy and paste.
No, he probably has, like, secret phone numbers. He's also a dad. Like, he's still lame. And why is he texting?
He's still lame.
You know, like, he should just be texting Giselle, and that's it. You know, what is he sending 80 texts a day? So clearly he was firing off some sketchy
stuff. I think that's an impossible standard that you're holding him to. No one should be asked to just text their partner and only their partner, no matter how famous or handsome they are. I think
I'm not asking him to. I'm just saying, like, once you get
to dad levels,
like, yeah.
I mean, I probably text more than that.
More than 80 a day.
I would definitely say more than 80 a day. I mean, we're including iMessage, right?
This could be a crowdsource hot take.
iMessage and text are the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give you like a weekend.
Especially the NFL, maybe.
Even think about my girlfriend. I send her like 20 to 30, you know, like one or two an hour. Two an hour. Just like, hey, what's up? Or like a smiley emoticon. I mean, totally. And sometimes what should be one text ends up being four because you're like, hey, oh, wait. And then, you know, you mess something up, so you put an asterisk and you fix your spelling if you care about grammar the way I do. So definitely more than 80.
Okay.
I'd be scared to know.
So if any Hot Takedown listeners have received one of Tom Brady's 80 text messages a day, please get in touch with us. Contact at 538.com.
Text us.
Text us, yes. Who's going to give out their phone
number? Here's Chad's cell phone.
I already text a lot, so here it is.
Yeah. Or tweet at us through your text messaging device, whatever works. We're eager to hear what Tom texted you. Allison, thanks as ever for bringing us the numbers from the frontier of Tom Brady's text messaging life.
Thanks for having me.
So that'll do it for this week's show. Kate Fagan, thanks for coming through. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne, thanks for being there.
Thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Jody Avergan, who has his own podcast that all of you should be listening
and
to
it's
if
really
you don't.
Good.
It's called What's the Point? You can find it on iTunes and all of your podcasting apps and devices. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. Our intern is Asa Chaturvedi. We get production help from Jordan Shulkin. Once again, thanks to SeatGeek for sponsoring the show. Remember to use the promo code TAKEDOWN when buying tickets on the SeatGeek app, also when buying seats on the TicketGeek app. You can email us at contact@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think and, as I mentioned earlier, what your text messages say. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're on iTunes, of course. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Leave a message while you're there, maybe in a review or a rating even. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chad McMatlin. Talk to you next time.